This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is David Rutledge. Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone on RN, and welcome this week to the shark-infested waters of gaming. If you're not a gamer, then you might wonder how gaming can be particularly contentious. It's all just a game, right? But even if you have no particular interest in gaming, you might still have heard of Gamergate, which was a weird outbreak of culture war in the gaming world that kicked off in 2014 and basically constituted a backlash against feminism among gaming developers and journalists. Over the course of around a year, women were threatened and harassed and doxxed, and many people believe that Gamergate laid down a sort of foundation for the later development of the extreme alt-right. So that's Gamergate, but alongside these issues of the treatment of women in the gaming world, there are issues of women and more broadly issues of gender in the games themselves. How should we treat gender in games? Should it be something incidental, devoid of any real significance in the world of the game? Or should games perhaps create environments where it's really important, where gender issues can be tackled head-on and strategies for gender justice be sort of road-tested? And if we like this idea of gaming as an ethical activity, does that mean that acting unethically in the world of the game should carry the same moral weight as acting unethically in the quote-unquote real world? Stephanie Rennick is a research associate in philosophy at the University of Glasgow, and she's been doing some very interesting work on gender in video games that involves examining the kinds of gender-related tropes that games employ and the ways that gender operates in gaming dialogue. Stephanie Rennick is speaking with Sam Barron.
The kinds of games we're interested in are RPGs or role-playing games, and they're games with really rich stories. So you see many of the same sorts of conversations you might expect to see in film or in television. That includes people that the main character speaks to, banter between friends. You might overhear conversations happening in the background. Sometimes there are conversations with particular choice structures. So if I were to be asked a question and answer one way, I might get a certain response. If I were to answer a different way, I might get a different response. So there are structurally quite a lot of things going on like we would expect to see in everyday life. Computer games have gotten really quite complicated, and we can see really quite complex and rich dialogue in there. So in the roughly 40 games we've got in the corpus, we've got more than 2 million words of dialogue. So it gives you a sense of just how much talking people are doing.
And so when you're playing one of these games, it's really sort of like, for some people, a kind of immersive movie where you're engaged in the narrative, engaged in the dialogue that you're having with these other characters. Is that right?
That's right. So one of the reasons that we might think that it's particularly important to think about how dialogue works in video games is that the player is an active participant in how that story goes. And one of the things we've been looking at is whether you can gamify how much female or male dialogue you get. So whether you could play the game in such a way as you know, mostly spoke to men or mostly spoke to women, and how much dialogue from each gender you would hear as a result. But yeah, generally speaking, what's distinct about this kind of medium is that people are taking part in the story. You are playing an active role in how things turn out.
Okay, and that's really interesting because it starts to sound like choice is a really important difference between the kind of analysis you might do, say, of movies, where you're looking at the way that gender is represented in movies, versus the kind of analysis that you're doing in computer games. So can you tell me a little bit about why you think choice is important here?
Yeah, certainly. So what can be a bit tricky about choice is that within the confines of a computer game, there are still only so many choices. There are still finite choices. So a lot of the choices have been made for the player before you sit down and play the game, right? Which characters are available for you to talk to, what sorts of things they will talk about, how they will appear to you. And so I think what can happen sometimes in video games is that we can feel like we're more in control of where the story goes than we in fact are. So something that people complain about when it comes to dialogue in video games is that it's often very structured. So the choices take place in a structure called dialogue trees. So you can imagine like a trunk of a tree with all of these branches. And if you hit a particular node, you might go along one branch or another branch, but there are only so many branches on the tree.
So you're interested in looking at the way that characters inside computer games talk to each other and how those sorts of dialogues might represent certain you know, stereotypes or things that we might see in movies, you know, the notion of the damsel in distress, for instance, the notion of the knight in shining armor, that sort of thing shows up in computer games as well. But I suppose what I want to get a sense of is why you think it's important to look at computer games in particular, rather than, say, looking at movies or looking at books or the other sorts of things that people generally focus on. Why do you get interested in computer games for this sort of thing?
I think all of those things are actually important. Where video games provide us with a sort of unique opportunity to do this research is that because of various challenges with doing this kind of research on video games, which we can talk about if you like, but because of that, it's less far along. The research hasn't been able to be done in the same sort of way. So if we think, as I do, that tropes shape our expectations, that is, like if a pattern recurs often enough, we come to expect it, then we can see that subverting or averting pernicious tropes, things like damsels in distress or men being expendable, is a way to disrupt and challenge those expectations. Whereas we've been able to see the opportunities to do that more easily with film and television, because it's easier to get the data to study what's going on there, it's not been so easy to do that with video games. And so we have this unique opportunity to do it. Now, as for why it's important, well, the work we are doing is premised on the idea that gender balance, gender diversity, gender representation is important. And I think in 2021, we should be past having to argue for it. But there's a nice quote from Laura Bates that I find motivating. She says, throughout history, everything that we do, everything that we believe about ourselves and other people, everything we plan for and work towards has been shaped by stories. The stories we hear as children help us to imagine and dream what the future might hold. The stories we learn as we grow up, help us to work out what our place is in the world, and the stories we tell when we're adults determine the legacy we leave behind. And every game that we're studying tells a story. And maybe that's surprising to people when they think about games as things like Tetris or Pac-Man. But games as a medium have developed, and they now tell these very rich narratives, and they're narratives in which the player has an active role. And I think the stories we tell through games could be aspirational. They could show the world as better as it really is, or they could shine a light on how it really is. But unfortunately, in many of them, women are silenced or backgrounded. And if you're genderqueer, non-binary or agender, then you just might not feature at all. And obviously, it's not just gender that matters. What's interesting about our research is that the materials we produce, the data set we produce, could be used by other researchers to investigate how race or sexuality or disability or class or age is depicted in games as well. But as I say, so I think it's less that games are more important than these other media to study, but rather that we've kind of missed an opportunity to look at them like we have other media.
So in your research, you're analyzing these games and analyzing the dialogue within these games. Can you tell me a little bit about how this process of analysis works and maybe the kinds of challenges that you might face that it's sort of unique to doing it in the computer game case?
Certainly. So we're building what linguists call a corpus, which is essentially a database of video game dialogue. So we need this for our own findings because it allows us to run automatic testing. So it allows us to automatically count the number of words or lines spoken by particular characters to do statistical analysis. But we also want to create a shareable resource because that's one of the problems with studying games is that whereas there are corpora for films and for TV, there are fewer, especially big ones, for video games. And that's because video game scripts are proprietary data. They belong to the game companies. So if we extracted the dialogue from the game code, we wouldn't be able to share it. So instead, what we're doing is using fan scripts. And these are like transcripts that people who play the game put hundreds of hours and loads of effort into producing. And then they release them online. And then my research partner, Sean, writes parsers or little computer programs that take a script and convert it into a standard format that both humans and machines can read. Machines so they can do the testing, but humans so we can make sense of what's going on. These parsing programs can be shared. So between the fan script online and this parsing program, other people can reconstruct the corpus at the press of a button. So that's how the corpus works. But there are technical, philosophical, and perhaps political challenges with doing this kind of work. So I've mentioned the tension between wanting the data for our purposes and thus wanting as much of it as possible, but also wanting the corpus to be shareable. It's technically difficult and a lot of work to parse the scripts. That's one thing. So there's this kind of extra difficulty that maybe doesn't exist I say is not the corpus linguist in the team, but it appears to me that it doesn't exist quite the same for other media as it does for games. Philosophically, it's difficult to assign gender to a lot of these NPCs. Sometimes there's internal disagreement within the game. Sometimes there's external disagreement within, like, between fans. Sometimes the character in question is not the sort of thing we would usually assign gender to, like a talking book, but players treat that character as if they have a gender. So there's kind of some philosophical conceptual work to be done there. And finally, it's fraught talking about video games and gender, especially when if what you say sounds critical. So Sean and I are doing this work because we think it's the right thing to do, and we think that it's important. We think that it has the potential to help us tell different stories with more diverse and representative characters. And we're also doing it because we love games, but it's not without its challenges.
And so you say it's sort of fraught if you're coming from a critical place or a critical perspective. Can you say a little bit more about that? Why is it fraught in particular if you're being critical about games or coming to it from a sort of philosophical, analytic place?
It's a really good question. Empirical evidence suggests that it is. So we've seen with social phenomena like Gamergate, with the reactions to female games journalists who have commented on games, people have a really strong sense of ownership when it comes to video games. Players do, understandably. I mean, and I say that as someone who plays games, when you play a role, when you, you know, step into the shoes of a character, one can become very attached to that media. And I think when people come along and say that there's something that could be better about your, about, you know, the thing that you love, there is a certain natural defensiveness. But I think on top of that, there's an awful lot of sexism and various other kinds of isms that just affect how people read this critique. So even as academics, unfortunately, there have been many people who have come out and said, this is how we can make things better, only to find their details released publicly, like where they live, only for them to be threatened in various ways. And all we're interested in doing is saying, hey, if you think these things matter, this is what the status quo is, and this is what you might do about it.
You're in the Philosopher's Zone. This week, producer Sam Barron is talking with Stephanie Rennick from the University of Glasgow about gender and video games.
There have been people receiving death threats. There have been people receiving all kinds of really awful threats about how dare they, essentially, how dare they speak about these things. We've got students working on this project with us, and we had to have, even as academics, really frank conversations. I say that even as academics, as if you would hope that when you are studying something critically and robustly and with the right kind of reverence, that people might see that for what it is. People might read that charitably. But as I say, we've got students working on the project who we had to say, we would love to credit you on this work, but we need you to think really hard about whether you want to be anonymous on the papers. And obviously, you know, we're happy to confirm that you worked on it when you're going for jobs and things like that. But, you know, that is something to genuinely consider. And the bulk of them have said that's what they want to do. They want to be anonymous because the risk of coming out and saying, hey, women don't talk as much, you know, as they should in computer games, or yeah, women are treated in this way. And for some reason, it's always when one talks about women. It doesn't seem to happen when one talks about men in that kind of way. So if I was to say, well, men are treated as the expendable gender in video games, and that's not good enough, which I think, right, which is true, I'm less likely to get a hard time about that than I am when I say, well, women's narratives are often just in the service of men's, rather than them having their own character development and plot, say.
And so one of the important things here, it seems to me, is something to do with silencing or suppressing certain kinds of voices. And this relates to a sort of bigger picture issue in philosophy, issues to do with justice surrounding who gets to speak and who doesn't. So is there a connection between the work that you're doing and broader issues involving voices and justice inside philosophy?
There are, yeah. So I think That gender representation in games perpetuates existing injustice. One of the things I'm interested in looking at when we look at this data set we've got is whether we see the kinds of injustice around things like who gets to talk and who's believed, that we observe in the real world, whether those are portrayed in games. So we might take, for instance, testimonial injustice, which has been talked about by people like Miranda Fricker and others. And the idea behind testimonial injustice is that women and people from other minority groups are often taken less seriously when they speak. They're less likely to be believed. In the literature, it said that they suffer a credibility deficit. So, for instance, when a woman reports that she's in pain to her doctor, she's less likely to be taken seriously. Or a woman making a suggestion in a board meeting at work might be less likely to be taken seriously. Because we're looking at dialogue, we're well placed to investigate whether we see this happening between fictional characters as well, whether it's been internalized to the extent that we see it play out in our fiction. So we can start to look at, you know, are women taken seriously by other characters when they make suggestions? Are they treated as experts? Do they answer questions or just ask them? And that's really interesting for me because I think that stories have the ability to kind of be aspirational, to make the world better than it is, or to show us how it might be better than it is. And if it's perpetuating these injustices that we see in the real world, I think that's worth shining a light on.
I'm wondering how this relates to the kinds of things that you can do in a computer game, the kinds of choices that you can make. I mean, you've talked a little bit about how the characters inside the game or the dialogue itself might perpetuate certain kinds of injustice or replicate that kind of injustice within the game world. But is there a sense in which a gamer can be made complicit or can become complicit in those kinds of acts by interacting with characters in a certain way, say by choosing to ignore a female character or choosing to have a certain kind of dialogue response to a female character inside a game?
I don't have a strong take on whether playing a game, even though you take an active role in the story, I'm not sure that playing a game makes you more complicit than watching a film where certain things are depicted. What I would say is that it's really important that when we show something that we think is a bad thing, say sexual harassment, right? I think most of us can agree that that's a bad thing. If we're to show that, just showing it isn't enough to subvert it. How other characters react to it, how it's handled, who's doing it, you know, whether we avert what we expect or subvert what we expect is really important too. So how much one should expect a player to take a part in that? Well, I think there's the scope to design games that really play with that idea, and it would be really lovely to see. But I also think that given the way that games are currently developed, even where players have choice, what those choices are, the range of those choices is determined for them by the developers. So I wouldn't want to go too far into saying I think players are complicit, because we do all sorts of things in video games that we wouldn't do in real life, like, you know, blow things up, for instance.
And so do you think there's a kind of almost a potential, at least, for a moral separation between what you do inside a game and what you do in the real world? It's not like you're doing something morally wrong, even if were you to do it in the real world, it would be considered morally wrong if you do it inside a computer game.
There are a lot of philosophers who think about this. So there are some very clever ethicists who work on the status of moral wrongs in video games, whether they're really morally wrong. I think we've agreed as a society that there are things we can get away with in games, just like there's things that can be depicted in film that couldn't be in real life. Although maybe interesting is that there are still limits to that. So people still feel very strongly about animal cruelty in games. For instance, that's often a way to signify a villain in a piece of media is, you know, if they'd kick a dog, then they must be a bad guy, even though everybody might be walking around with a gun. So I do think there are some wrongs that seem to continue to be wrongs or treated as wrongs inside and outside of games. But whether all moral wrongs count in the same sort of way, I leave to the ethicists.
So if we sort of think about it then from a more metaphysical perspective, and we're thinking about sort of notions of gender and notions of injustice, what kinds of metaphysical lessons do you think we can draw out from this work of studying gender inside a computer game?
Well, if we think from a sort of feminist metaphysical perspective, let's say, although I don't love that term, but if we think that people are people, and we should treat them well, and that a lot of these categories are morally arbitrary. So somebody shouldn't be treated differently because of the color of their skin or because of the social class they were born into. then we have the opportunity in games to be representing the groupings and the kind of concepts that we have in the real world and playing with them in game space. So one possibility that some games explore is to treat gender in games as purely aesthetic, to have it be incidental, to have a man and woman just be treated the same. And we see games that don't do that. So one of the games in the corpus has, if you play as a male character or if you play as a female character, the other characters in the game treat you differently. So if you're a man and you go into a restaurant, you're offered pasta. If you're a woman, you're given salad. If you're a man, beer. If you're a woman, wine. One of the characters describes the male as energetic and the woman as beautiful. And when this happens systematically through a game, you know, it raises some eyebrows, I think, or it should. But there are games that don't do that at all, that instead say, nope, you can have the same background, you can have the same role in the narrative, no matter whether you're a man or a woman. And I think there's a sense in which that can seem really aspirational. It's treating gender as no barrier to doing the sorts of amazing feats that the heroes go on to do. The flip side to that, of course, is that it might stop us telling certain kinds of stories that reflect experiences distinctive to particular groups, like gender-based oppression, for instance, or toxic masculinity or something. And so my instinct is that diversity of stories is the answer here. In philosophy, we're often looking for the one truth. But actually, I think that in fiction, we can depict many ways the world could be. Right? There are various ways to subvert and avert the tired tropes. My hope is that by helping to shine a light on some of the existing patterns, that then creators, much more imaginative people than me, can go on to transcend them.
And so I guess we're starting to talk a little bit here about the sorts of things that you could do to address potentially the kinds of injustices inside computer games. So what sorts of things could we as game players or consumers of computer games or developers do to try and maybe address some of the kinds of things about testimonial injustice that we've been talking about?
Oh, interesting. Okay, so I think the first step is just to understand what the patterns are, right? To be a bit more reflective about what's going on. One question I think players can ask when they're playing a game is, would it have made a difference if this character I'm interacting with, or this character in a film, or this character in TV, would it have made a difference if they were a different gender? So is the case that this is a caring nurse and that they're female, would it have read differently to me if it was a man? I think that's kind of some interesting introspective work we can do. And in real life, would I have treated them differently if they were? I think for developers, there's a few suggestions. So one thing is have women speak to each other. It looks like there's a statistically significant bias towards men speaking to men, even when we normalize for the proportion of male and female characters. So have women speak to each other, not just to men. Have them talk about things other than men and use language to do more than comfort, gush, or flirt. So that's one of the things that we haven't really talked about is it's not just about what you say, although what you say is really important. It's also about the pragmatics of language. It's also about what we use language to do. So are women allowed to give orders? Are they allowed to give suggestions or instructions? And are they taken seriously? Or is their role just to validate? Or to ask questions to allow the hero, often male, to sweep in and give the answer. Consider deciding on the gender of a character later in their development, after you've decided on their occupation and personality. So try doing it randomly, right? And there are games that do this. So there's a game called Daggerfall, which has an algorithm which randomly assigns whether an NPC is male or female. Unfortunately, it does that as a second step. It first asks, is this character a guard? And if the character is a guard, they're always a man. But after that, it randomly assigns. Ask yourself things like, does the person doing the emotional labor need to be a woman? Do all the hundreds of enemies you mow down need to be men? But I think if there was one lesson developers could learn from the data we've got so far is this. Why don't women talk more in video games? And they don't. They don't talk nearly as much as men most of the time. Because there's not enough of them talking. So we had thought, well, maybe it's that women are just silenced, women just don't talk enough, that what we need to do is give women more dialogue. But actually, what it looks like from the data, and this surprised us, but I think is promising, if you think parity is important, then add more women, because across the board, they're speaking as much as you would expect them to. There's just far fewer of them talking than there are men. So the number one thing is just have more female characters. That's not going to solve all the problems, but it's a solid first step.
And are there any games that actually manage to do this particularly well at the moment?
That's challenging. One game I really enjoyed playing as a female character, although I'm going to get slagged for this because lots of people didn't like the game, was Mass Effect Andromeda. And the reason was, if you played that as a female character, it's a sci-fi, it's set in space, and humans are colonizing with their alien compatriots, colonizing a new galaxy. And if you play that as a female, then there are various women characters in high-ranking roles in charge of the different alien races or in charge of the different ships. And you have these conversations where you're deciding on what should happen for humanity and how, you know, as a species, we can grow and develop, which feel very different from the kinds of conversations that women have with each other in media. I mean, obviously in real life, women are capable of making, you know, strategic decisions and having rich political discussions, but it's not so often that we see that depicted. And so playing that game, I really liked, but the data is still out. There's nothing yet that we've got in the corpus that I would say, yep, that definitely gets it right. Interestingly, one of the games, so what we've seen across the board is that with the exception of two quite idiosyncratic games, women speak far less than 50% of all the dialogue in a given game. And that's the case even in games that have female protagonists. So for instance, Final Fantasy X2, which came out years ago, some of your listeners might have played, has three female leads, and they still don't speak more than 50% of the time. So, yeah, more women. That's the answer.
More women and more women talking.
More women and more women talking. And it's not just in video games. I mean, we see it in Disney films as well. There was a really interesting study done a few years ago that showed that Disney princesses in the 50s and 60s spoke a lot more than Disney princesses today. So I think Sleeping Beauty in the Sleeping Beauty film, although Sleeping Beauty herself spends most of the film asleep, female characters in that movie speak about 70% of the time. In Frozen, which has two female leads, they speak something like 41% of the time. So it's not just about having female leads. It's not just about having a few females who speak a lot. It's about, and I'm using females, but I mean gender, not sex. It's just that there's not a good word that means women that includes girls. What we're seeing is just that there's not enough of them speaking. We need more of them. More sidekicks, more background characters, more frontline characters.
Thank you so much for joining me to talk about gender in computer games today, Stephanie.
Very welcome. Anytime.
And Stephanie Rennick is a research associate in philosophy at the University of Glasgow. She was speaking there with producer Sam Barron. Stephanie Rennick, I should add, is worth checking out online. She's done work on time travel. She runs events designed to foster public engagement with philosophy by tying it in with films and comics and TV and various other aspects of pop culture. She's got a lot going on, and we're going to put a link to her website on our website. That's The Philosopher's Zone, and you can find us at abc.net.au/rn. Look for us on the program menu. Thanks so much for your company this week. I'm David Rutledge, and I hope you can join me next week when we're going to be asking, are children philosophers? And if the answer is yes, what kind of philosophers are they? See you then.